Hello and welcome to Meandering with Myrn, a potpourri of podcasts by me, veterinary ethologist Myrna Milani. Join me as I ponder any and all things animal and human, what we know and what we don't, where we've been, where we are, and where we're headed. This month's commentary discusses the gap that may occur between the environments in which canine behavior studies are conducted and those in which companion canines actually live. But even when studies are conducted in the animal's home, researchers often will focus strictly on that element they wish to study. They either eliminate the existence of others or assume these remain unchanged throughout the study. I first became aware of the limitations of this approach in bond studies during the presentation of a study that examined the benefits of animal companionship on human health. Specifically, it involved the use of a family dog as a support animal for a child with developmental and emotional disabilities. To look at the data, the relationship was a success. During the period in which the dog and child interacted on a daily basis, the child's behavior improved. However, a comment made by the presenter in her closing remarks stuck in my mind, as did every slide that included the dog shown during her presentation. Unfortunately, she told us, the study had to be terminated because the dog developed medical problems. From the pictures of the dog, I assume the medical problems included lick granulomas. For those unfamiliar with the condition, these are angry red raised masses caused by chronic licking, often in response to chronic stress. In my ideal world, all human-animal bond studies simultaneously would monitor the well-being of the animal as well as the person. But in the real world of science, the dog's granulomas were, at best, an unintended side effect of the study that couldn't be ignored when the dog's discomfort became apparent. At worst, the researcher recognized no relationship between the two and dismissed the masses as an unfortunate variable unrelated to the child's relationship with the dog. Thankfully, animal welfare safeguards have improved greatly since then. At the same time, though, the collection of bond or behavioral data that uses online surveys has become more popular. No one can argue that such surveys enable researchers to gain more data from more people at a fraction of the time and cost compared to doing this face-to-face. It also makes it easier to ignore all those messy variables that can crop up when data is collected in the owner and animal's home environment. However, the variables still will be there, as anyone who has completed an online survey knows. The researcher won't know that the survey taker is hungover, or that her dog now lives part-time with her ex, or that her neighbor just got a dog that her cat despises. But the survey taker will. The accuracy of online survey results and any conclusions drawn from them also depends on two other factors: the kinds of questions asked, and the answering options supplied. I'm the first to admit that the probability that I fit into what most researchers consider a suitable study population is low. I routinely get requests to fill out surveys from various animal or veterinary marketing organizations. Some are so desirous of my input, they'll even offer to pay me a few dollars to do this, or they'll include my name in a drawing for some fabulous prize. This past year, I also got several requests from the U.S. Census Bureau asking me to fill out lengthy online surveys regarding my business. However, the incentive here wasn't quite so sweet. These requests came with repeated warnings that failure to complete the survey by the required date was a federal offense. However, regardless of the source, it soon became obvious that I didn't fit the profile those who designed the survey had in mind. In the ones from marketing groups, the process was blatantly discriminatory. After answering questions related to my age, sex, race, ethnicity, country and state of residence, marital state, and income range, I inevitably got booted out. I have no idea whether one particular answer got me the old heave-ho, or whether some combination of sins determined by an algorithm sealed my fate. But it's not the discrimination that bothers me. That's a normal part of life for all of us, in one way or another. It's their wasting my time that irks me. Alas, the government forms offered no such release. I had to stumble through pages of multiple choice questions with few and sometimes no choices that applied to me and my business, or else I'd go to jail. Initially, this bothered me because I knew in my own tiny little way, fudging my answers to make them fit the forms was skewing their data. But after two calls to their helpline and hearing two very nice people tell me not to worry, just do my best, I gave up. This naturally got me thinking even more about those online surveys that ask dog and cat owners about their pets' behaviors or their bonds with them. How do those survey designers determine their multiple choice options? Based on the results, some of them give participants only those choices that interest the researcher. They either can't imagine or don't care that their options may not include choices that apply to the survey takers or their animals. The most annoying surveys among these force participants to choose an incorrect answer to continue the survey. Better designed surveys acknowledge the limitations of their offered options and include one of two additional choices: I don't know, or none of the above. The I don't know option does work if you truly don't know what you or your animal would do under the circumstances described in the question. But if you do know and the options don't include it, then the I don't know is a lie. None of the above creates less of an ethical dilemma for the survey taker, but it still creates a frustrating dilemma for those who do know what they or their animals would do. It's the survey designers who don't know. But fear not, enough I don't know responses will cause most researchers to accept that their survey was poorly designed and that their data invalid. Yes/no questions can be even more problematic. Consider the question, does your dog know the come command? Most dogs, who went through even the most basic training, know the command. But how or when or even if they respond to it may vary greatly. Then there are all those people who use another command that means the same thing. The survey completely ignores their existence. So how accurate are online results when it comes to animal behavior or bond studies? And how reliable are any conclusions the researchers draw from them, given how little they may know about the people and animals involved? Ultimately, I suspect it boils down to how much faith their audience has in numbers and how closely the researcher's conclusion match their own experience or expectations. This doesn't mean that I think we should give up trying to learn as much as possible about the human-animal bond and companion animal behavior at a time when research funds are limited. I just think that online surveys regarding these subjects should include a section for comments following every question. The majority of those replying to surveys want to provide the correct information. Why not make it easy for them to do so instead of impossible? I find the studies that utilize this approach and include direct quotations from survey takers in their written or oral presentations of the results are much more informative, especially for those of us who live or work with real people and animals on a daily basis. At best, analyses of data can give us a general idea of what's going on in the statistically significant portions of a population. But those added comments referring to specific people and specific animals can teach us a lot about what goes on beyond the norm. I can say from personal experience that these comments can generate powerful insights into animal behavior and the human companion animal bond we otherwise might miss. These may not be statistically significant relative to the population, but they are precise. They may not mean much to the researcher, but to the minority who has shared or knows those with a similar bond with an animal, or who has noticed similar behavioral displays in their own or other animals with whom they work, they can trigger profound shifts in bond and behavioral perception.
You've been listening to a podcast by veterinary ethologist Myrna Milani. For more podcasts, commentaries, and books about animal behavior and the human-animal bond, and links to behavior and bond sites, check out my website at www.mmilani.com. For more specific information, feel free to email me at mm@mmilani.com. All rights related to the content of these podcasts are retained by Myrna Milani. The background music, Molly on the Shore by Percy Granger, is used with permission from Katova Arts, www.katova.com.